Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Great Lakes hold 20% of the world's supply of surface fresh water and provide sustenance, work, and recreation for tens of millions of Americans. But they are under threat as never before, and their problems are spreading across the continent. This morning we talk with Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, about the ecological catastrophe happening right before our eyes, what has caused the perils that now face this vital and iconic ecosystem, and the ways we can restore and preserve the lakes for generations to come. Dan, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, the first thing I realized as I started reading your book is how little I actually know about the Great Lakes. And what really surprised me was learning that they're actually a major river system. So that's probably a surprise for most people who don't live in that area, around where you live in the Great Lakes region. And I wonder if you can explain how it is that they are, in fact, part of a major river system.
Sure. I mean, that's taking, I described that. I took some license by calling them an oversized river, but they are in a very real sense. All the Great Lakes, Superior, Michigan, Huron, Erie, and Ontario, flow out toward the Atlantic Ocean via the St. Lawrence River. So water as far west as Duluth eventually makes its way across Lake Superior, down the St. Mary's River, into Lake Huron, which is really the same lake as Michigan. It's two lobes of one giant body of water. From there, it goes down another river, the St. Clair River, into Lake Erie, and then it goes out Lake Erie, over Niagara Falls, through Lake Ontario, and down the St. Lawrence River. So, yeah, it's not like it's a static system, that these are just giant puddles of glacial meltwater. They're constantly being drained to the ocean and constantly being replenished with precipitation and inflows from their tributaries.
So, in fact, it sounds like, are they like the second largest river system, part of the second largest river system in the country after the Mississippi, Missouri?
As defined by what? The landmass drained or the volume flowing out?
Let's do both, actually. Because I know that the St. Lawrence River has a huge amount of volume flowing out. And
yeah, I don't have the cubic feet per second in front of me right now, but it isn't as great as the Mississippi. And the landmass drained, if you look at a map of the Great Lakes Basin, the basin line is really close to the lakes themselves. The Mississippi is a whole different deal. The Mississippi spans some 40% of the continental United States. That means 40% of the acreage in the lower 48 is drained by the Mississippi and ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. The Great Lakes Basin isn't that size, but it's also got a lot of water banked in it in the form of these lakes, which collectively hold some, as you mentioned, 20% of the world's surface freshwater and approaching 90% of the nation's.
But in fact, I mean, the fact that you say the water starts flowing from Duluth, Minnesota, all the way to the mouth of the St. Lawrence River in the Atlantic Ocean, I mean, that's just about halfway across the country, halfway across the continent. And it also seems like this leads to the fantasy or the dream that many civic leaders and politicians and commercial leaders have had over probably a couple centuries to turn that waterway into a navigable waterway to actually reach the center of the country from the East Coast.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that was the whole idea behind the St. Lawrence Seaway, which is basically a man-made system of channels, locks, and canals that tamed the roaring St. Lawrence River so boats could sail up and down that riverway into Lake Ontario, and then above Lake Ontario is Niagara Falls, and that's 175 foot or something like that wall of dolomite, and that was conquered, if you will, by the Welland Canal, which is now considered part of the St. Lawrence Seaway. But that was a canal system that allowed boats to bypass Niagara Falls and move between Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the river systems and lakes above that was all fairly naturally navigable. It was made more navigable for bigger boats upon completion of the St. Lawrence Seaway in 1959. But yeah, regional leaders would look at a map and they would just see this big blob of blue in the heart of the continent and think, it looks like we could sail in and out. On a two-dimensional map, let's make it real in 3D life. And that's what they did, and it's had some success and it's had some failure.
Well, actually, didn't the start of trying to get cross land through the rather small waterways to the Great Lakes begin with the Erie Canal?
Yes, that was actually the first kind of breach in what was once the great isolation of the Great Lakes. They're huge. They span some 94,000 square miles, which is roughly the size of the United Kingdom. But despite that size, they were really as isolated as a pond high up in the mountains or in Wisconsin's North Woods, and that's because there was no exchange of water between the Great Lakes Basin and the Mississippi River Basin. And as far as access for organisms to make it up into the lakes, they were protected by that roaring St. Lawrence River that I mentioned previously, and then obviously Niagara Falls. Stuff might be able to tumble over it, but it wasn't going to, nothing was going to swim up Niagara Falls.
Well, before we get into how that impenetrable wall was breached, I just wanted to talk a bit more about the St. Lawrence Seaway, because when I started reading about it, it triggered two memories. And one of them, I think I was in third grade reading about the St. Lawrence Seaway being built, and it was reading it in my weekly reader. And it sounded kind of, I didn't quite get it. I mean, I had a hard time understanding between the St. Lawrence River and the St. Lawrence Seaway and what they were doing. But it seemed like it was this great engineering feat, and we as third graders should be really excited about it. And then quite a few years later, I actually drove along it, my first trip across Canada, and it looked kind of like going through a ghost town. It was really disappointing after all the hype I had heard about it when I was a kid. So what happened to the St. Lawrence Seaway, and why did it look so desolate in the early 70s?
Okay, well, I think there were two problems with the Seaway, maybe three. I'll say the first one is the maybe one, and that is it promised too much. People were expecting here in the Midwest that suddenly, with its completion, cities like Chicago and Milwaukee and Duluth and Buffalo and Cleveland were about to turn into world-class global ports. That didn't happen, and it didn't happen for two primary reasons. The first is, as I mentioned earlier, the Welland Canal. That was first built opened up right after the Erie Canal in the 1820s. I believe the Welland Canal, the first one, was finished in the 1830s. And they kept expanding it over and over until the early 1930s when the existing Welland Canal was completed. So in the 1950s, they decided to, I guess the words would be, finish the job by making the route. So just to remind the listeners, the Welland Canal connects Lake Ontario with Lake Erie and all the lakes above it.
And bypasses Niagara Falls.
By bypassing Niagara Falls. And the St. Lawrence Seaway technically is the set of locks and canals below Lake Ontario. It'd be great if I had a map that I could show everybody.
Let's visualize it. There's a map on our website, actually, that I put up.
Okay, well, yeah. If there's people listening in range of a computer, it might help to pull up. But yeah, so below Lake Ontario was the St. Lawrence River, and that was just too wild for any ship to navigate. And so during much of the 19th and early 20th century, there were some smaller locks and canals built. But the idea behind the Seaway was to once and for all build a big-time navigation system. The problem was the Welland Canal had only been finished in the early 1930s, and now we're here in the 1950s, and to really make it, you know, a system that could even handle, you know, the size of the fleet, the world's cargo-carrying fleet in the 1950s and 60s, they would have had to rebuild the Welland Canal, which would have doubled the cost of the project. So they decided to essentially build it on the cheap. And the reason was the East Coast ports, the East Coast states didn't want competition from the Great Lakes. The railroads didn't want competition from the Great Lakes. Canada was going to build this system on its own, and the U.S. wanted to have a say in how it was managed, so we agreed to build it, but we built it really on the small and on the cheap. So the boats that can fit in it really reflect what the world's fleet looked like in the 1920s rather than even in the 1960s, and especially rather than what's sailing on the ocean today. Coincidentally, when the Seaway was finished in 1959, or while it was being constructed, I believe it was 1956, the first container vessel set sail from New Jersey down to Texas. And that launched, you know, just almost like a size race among the shipping industry, the freighter business, and boats have been getting bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where today, less than about 5% of the world's fleet in terms of cargo carrying capacity can squeeze its way into the locks of the Seaway and then into the Great Lakes. So we don't have big container vessels coming in. Another problem, the second problem with the Seaway, is that it freezes over for 3 months a year. And you need a navigation corridor to be open year-round for it to be, you know, a viable option for a lot of industries. If you're a car factory and, you know, you're depending in just-in-time delivery for, say, clutches, you can't go without your clutches for January, February, and March. So the Seaway was always burdened by ice, and it's become increasingly burdened by its size. And the result is that it's kind of become something like a nautical narrow-gauge railroad. A relatively small number of boats can make their way in, and they're not carrying high-valued finished goods like Sony's or Toyota's or Nike's. Actually, Nike's wouldn't be imported, obviously. Well,
imported from the other direction.
But anyway, it's basically relatively low value bulk goods. We've got primarily steel coming in from ports around the world, and then we ship out grain. So we didn't get the cargo that we hoped for, but we got a type of cargo that we didn't plan on, and that's really kind of what this story is about.
And that's what we're going to talk about for the next half hour. So okay. Why was it so easy for this other kind of cargo to make it to Duluth, I guess eventually, but definitely throughout most of the Great Lakes, while it was so hard to get desirable cargo to the centers of commerce in the Great Lakes region?
Okay, well, you know...
Before we get there, actually, I just want to talk a little bit about the... Because we haven't mentioned this. How you mentioned that this is a very isolated ecosystem. What does that mean in terms of the kind of wildlife that thrived in the Great Lakes for millions of years?
That's a really good question. And actually, what's remarkable, there's many remarkable things about the Great Lakes, but one of them is that they're so young. They're only about 10,000 years old. And so they were the basins that cradle the lakes... were carved by the glaciers, and then they were filled up by the glaciers, and then, you know, as the water started to overflow, it created these river channels, which ended up in what we have today, this extensive river system that slowly drains the lakes, and then precipitation slowly fills up the lakes. But if this happened in the middle of the continent, and it happened, you know, with a big chunk of ice, an obvious question is, well, okay, where did the fish come from? Well, as the glaciers would wax and wane over the last big glaciation, there was always rivers coming off the front, off the snout of the glacier, and in those rivers lurked fish species. And as those glaciers retreated, the fish would follow up the meltwater into the lakes, where eventually everything got sealed off, and what was there was what the lakes had. And it was a relatively small assemblage of fish that had the ability to live in rivers, and then once the rivers got sealed off and the lakes filled up, live in these big bodies of open water. And I don't know if your listeners haven't been to the Great Lakes. They really, lake doesn't do the word justice. I mean, you stand on the edge of them, and it feels like you're standing on the edge of an ocean.
I actually just interject for a second, because the first time I was at a Great Lake, which was, I think, Lake Ontario in Toronto, and we were standing at the shore of Lake Ontario, amazed because it was the first lake I'd ever been at, which there's no way to see to the other side. But my friends who I was with, they were all from New York, and we said, it doesn't feel like the ocean, it feels like lake vibes. So what is the difference between lake vibes and the ocean?
I'm sorry, lake vibes?
Lake vibes. It felt like, you know, the vibration off the lakes was lakes. It really felt very different from being at the ocean, even though it felt as vast as the ocean.
Well, I would say probably because of the smells and the color and the size of the waves. But I'll say that these waves, you don't see them every day, but waves on the Great Lakes can exceed 20 feet. They can get as big as 25 feet. They can sink big boats like the Edmund Fitzgerald. But I'm not an ocean guy, so I don't know really what the ocean vibe is. But I've been to the ocean, and I've been to the Great Lakes, and to me... And to anybody, really, the view is just as expansive. It's pretty incredible. But again, so they were isolated, and that made them, they were really young. You know, they're only 10,000 years old, and they were filled with this pretty simple assemblage of fish. You had lake trout at the top of the food chain, and then you had a bunch of smaller forage species that were whitefish, and then species that pretty closely resembled whitefish, and then you had smaller fish, and then, you know, you had your zooplankton, phytoplankton, and down it went. They were so young that what made them uniquely vulnerable to the invasive species is that they didn't really, they were ecologically naive is a word that biologists like to use, and that makes them vulnerable, like a baby. It hasn't built up an immune system. It doesn't have a lot of experience dealing with outside competition. And when that competition came, it came fast and hard, and it came because of the opening of the seaway and the channels, the shipping channels before it. And I could go through and talk about, you know, the succession of invasions. And, you know, it started with taking out the top of the food chain, and it's ended up with taking out the bottom of the food chain. I don't know if you want to go in that direction.
Well, I do want to go in that direction, but first I want people to know that you're listening to KBOO this morning here on Locus Focus, and I'm talking with Dan Egan, who is the author of Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and we're looking at ecological catastrophe that's been happening right before our eyes, actually now for several, well, probably for many decades now. Yeah, so let's talk about how this invasive species invasion began, and okay. We'll start with the Great Lakes, and I guess we'll end up with a threat to the Columbia River if we get all the way there.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so we talked earlier about the Welland Canal and the Erie Canal, which were predecessors to the St. Lawrence Seaway. And those were really the first big chinks in the, or cracks in the protective skin, if you will, of the Great Lakes. And so the first real trouble that came in, biological trouble, came up these shipping channels and around Niagara Falls through these locks. And, you know, I'd imagine the listeners know what locks are, but they're basically just hydraulic lifts for big boats. But they can also accommodate what else may come swimming in with these boats. And the first big invader in the Great Lakes was the sea lamprey, which is a parasite that is eel-like. It doesn't eat fish. It just attaches to their stomachs and sucks the life out of them. So I had mentioned earlier that the Great Lakes were pretty ecologically naive, and the lamprey demonstrated. They're like these, they've been called aquatic vampires. They came in, and I think the first lamprey was discovered above Niagara Falls in Lake Erie in the early 1920s. And then they inexorably spread westward up into Lake Huron in Michigan and then Lake Superior. And they literally took out the lake trout. In the early 1940s, Lake Michigan was still yielding some 6 million pounds of lake trout to commercial fishermen annually, and a similar amount of whitefish. By the end of the decade, those stocks were gone commercially, and it was a similar story on the other Great Lakes. The lamprey came in and just went to town, and the lake trout were really the one true predator, big predator in the system. The top of the food chain, the wolf, if you will, and when it went away, the smaller fish below it, the fish that were too small to fall prey to these lamprey, which grow, they can grow 2 or 3 feet long and eat 40 pounds, not eat, kill or consume some 40 pounds of fish for the year and a half that they spend in the lakes as an adult, and they kill by just sucking the blood and the juices out of the host fish. So we lost the lake trout. And the lamprey were, you know, then they went to the whitefish, and they would latch on to anything that was decent size. But behind the lampreys came alewives, which is another fish from the East Coast. The lamprey looks like an eel, but it's a fish. In came alewives, which are on the East Coast, some places known as river herrings. They're anadromous, like your salmon out there. They, you know, spend their adults in the ocean, and they spawn in the freshwater rivers and streams. On the eastern part of the continent. They followed the lampreys into the Great Lakes, and with no lake trout there to gobble up these little herring, which really wouldn't grow much longer than a pocket comb, and just a, you know, maybe 3 or 4 ounces, they exploded to the point that in the 1950s, you know, the 1940s, you have the lake full of lake trout and whitefish. In the 1960s, biologists were estimating that the biomass of Lake Michigan was 90% alewife. So for every 10 pounds of fish swimming in the lake, 9 pounds of it were alewives. And because this was not a true freshwater species, these fish are constantly under stress in this freshwater, and that makes them uniquely vulnerable to the temperature swings that are common in the Great Lakes. And so while they were great at reproducing, they weren't so great at living in the Great Lakes, and they started dying off by the billions seasonally. And so you had these lakes that for, you know, more than a century were a source of, you know, these succulent freshwater fillets. Now these lakes are retching these little rotting fish that are inedible. And, I mean, the only commercial application for them, they were harvesting them and using them for fertilizer and, I believe, cat food for a while. But there were way more dying than anybody could handle, to the point that in the mid-1960s, I mean, Chicago was burning and bulldozing and burying and even throwing some types of perfume on these rotting mounds of fish just so people who lived in some of the tonier suburbs of Chicago could breathe air that didn't make them sick. So the lake was really, the lakes were really, really out of whack by the middle of the 1960s.
Did the alewives make it all the way up to Lake Superior?
They did, but not to the same extent. Lake Superior is a much colder system and less productive. So Lake Superior, while it did suffer a lamprey invasion and some subsequent invasions, it's been better insulated than Lake Michigan and Huron, Erie, and Ontario. So here we are, and interject if you have a question or if you want to go in a different direction. But so we have lampreys that will eat whatever pops to a big enough size for them to latch on, and below that you have alewives just going to town, and so the biologists here in the Great Lakes region knew they had to fix or try to fix the problem. And that's the thing. There was no guarantee at the point that they started trying to manage this situation that they'd ever be able to manage their way out of it. And it started with an idea that they had to kill the lampreys. Now, whether the lakes have the ocean vibe or not, they are huge, especially when you're talking about trying to eliminate a certain species that's, you know, everywhere out there in the open waters. And the idea was that they were going to try to find some lamprey-specific poison. But you couldn't brew enough poison to poison a Great Lake. That being said, the lampreys were and are uniquely vulnerable because they're an ancient, ancient fish. They have, I think they've got fossils that are approaching 400 million years old, and they haven't really had an evolutionary tune-up since then. They may have added a few of teeth in their suction mouth, and they've gotten a little bit bigger, but they're basically, you know, what's been swimming in the oceans for hundreds of millions of years. And this has left them with a relatively crude liver, and because of this crude liver, they were more vulnerable to certain types of poison than other fish species. So the first thing the biologists did was they tried to figure out everything they could about the life cycle of the lampreys, and they got lucky. Because it turned out they had something of an Achilles, what would an eel have, an Achilles fin? And they had a weakness, and that weakness in their life cycle was they spawned in only relatively few rivers and streams that feed the Great Lakes, and they spent most of their life in the larval stage where they're just basically like nightcrawler-sized eel-like fish, buried in the sediments of these streams with just their mouth sticking out and sucking up whatever food comes their way. And once they reach an age of about, I think it's 5 or 6 years old, then they mature and they pop out of the stream beds and descend down into the lakes and spend 18 months taking out any kind of large fish they can find before they return to these streams and rivers to spawn and die. So the biologists figured they had them cornered. Because, you know, the vast majority of lampreys in the lakes were in this juvenile state, and they were not out in the big water, so you weren't talking about dumping barrels of poison or freighters of poison out into the Great Lakes. You were talking about very specifically targeting these tributaries that were prime lamprey habitat. So once they figured that out, the next thing they had to figure out was a poison that would be specific to lampreys. And this took years. It took like 3 years of just testing poisons in what was a pretty relatively crude but effective testing system where they would put lampreys in an aquarium with some other species of freshwater fish, and they'd put a poison in. And if the lampreys could survive or would die and the other fish would thrive, then they found their magic poison. And it took thousands of tests before they hit on one where the fish flitted away just fine and the lampreys went limp, and so they had their poison. And it turned out to be pretty darn lamprey specific. They actually dubbed it lampricide, which I think maybe was a marketing thing to make everybody feel good about all this poison that they were about to put into the tributaries feeding the Great Lakes. But it has proven to be remarkably targeted for lampreys. And so they started poisoning these tributaries, and they were able to knock down the lamprey population to about 10% of its peak. So now we have a lake full of forage fish, lakes full of forage fish. The lampreys are gone. This is an opportunity to bring back a predator. And you mentioned Lake Superior earlier as to whether it had suffered a similar infestation of alewives. It didn't to the extent of the other lakes. And because of its harsh environment, while the lampreys did do a number on the lake trout up there, they didn't knock them out entirely. So there were remnant stocks, and so those could be used to repopulate the other Great Lakes. And that was always the plan of the federal biologists that concocted this lamprey poison. But it turned out that the states, which really have management over the Great Lakes, largely because they control the bottomlands, they're jointly managed by, or jointly owned, I guess, by the Great Lakes states of, there's eight of them, let's see if I can get them, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York. And so what one state does to a Great Lake, it does, you know, all states suffer the consequences or benefit from it. And Michigan decided that they did not want to go with lake trout. And the reason was lake trout, while they were a very popular commercial fish species, they weren't really popular with recreational fishermen because they don't put up that big of a fight. And they don't grow very fast. They can take 25, 30 years to reach their maximum size, whereas I'm sure your listeners know about the salmon life cycle. It's much more compressed.
Like 5 years.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years out there in the ocean, coming back to spawn. So you know, it had already been demonstrated that these ocean fish, lampreys and alewives, could make a go of it in the Great Lakes. And this Michigan fisheries biologist who had spent his early career in Colorado, where, you know, Western fisheries management in reservoirs is completely different because you basically inherit a blank slate and you can build what you want from there. He brought that kind of ethic and mentality back to Michigan. And he decided that there was a sexier predator out there than lake trout. And they initially considered sea bass or striped bass, but then they ended up going with coho and Chinook salmon that were shared by, is it the Oregon Fish and Game?
Yeah,
Game
and Fish and Game.
Yeah, it was Oregon Fish and Game. They basically gave Michigan some coho, and then and in 1966, and the Michigan biologists didn't know what was going to happen. They'd done some studies, but they really didn't know if they were going to just die, if they were going to, like, you know, somehow have a nose for salt and head out the seaway to the Atlantic, or if they were going to just completely take off. And they didn't consult the other states, let alone the other the two Canadian provinces, Quebec and Ontario, that have joint management of the Great Lakes. They just put them in, and they like hit a home run in terms of finding a fish that was nature-built to go after alewives. First it was coho, and then they later added Chinook. And so you had this Atlantic invader, the alewives, being controlled by this Pacific predator, salmon, and it created a salmon fishery that was just extraordinary. I mean, the catch rate was insane.
Probably the Pacific Northwest salmon fishery was crashing. It's kind of ironic.
Yeah, it is. It is. And as a matter of fact, the lake trout, which are still suffering to this day, are an invasive species in Yellowstone, and those fish literally came from Lake Michigan. But we're getting a little...
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Egan, who's author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, about the great ecological catastrophes that have been unfolding in the Great Lakes for decades and are kind of beginning to threaten the rest of the continent. Dan, I'm thinking, I don't think we're going to finish everything I want to talk about today. So can we figure on doing another program in a few weeks?
Yeah, I think I can do that.
Because what I'd like to do is finish talking about the fish today, and then next time we can talk about ballast water and the mollusks,
sure,
the mussels. So then I feel more relaxed and we can get into the carp and all the other things. So first of all, what happened to the salmon fishery in the Great Lakes?
Okay, so So, and this is interesting because the salmon pioneer, a great guy, he's still alive. He's in his early 90s. His name is Howard Tanner, and I interviewed him a few times for this book. He still bristles at the idea that he was brought in to solve the Great Lakes alewife infestation. He never looked at the alewives as like aquatic cockroaches, which is the way a lot of people looked at them. He looked at them as a resource. He looked at them as a food source for, you know, some kind of prized fish, and he picked salmon to be that fish. He once described it to me. He said, you know, if a rancher came across an island with chest-high grass, do you think he'd think, oh, I'm going to put a couple cows on there and get rid of all that grass? No, he's going to think, I could raise more beef on that island than you can imagine. And so that was his idea. Don't get rid of the alewives, just use salmon to feed on them. And so they put the salmon in, and like I said, they didn't know if they'd be able to live or reproduce, and it turned out initially they weren't able to reproduce. They had to plant them every year. And so, you know, they'd raise them in hatcheries, they'd put them in the lakes, and they'd spend about 3 years in the lakes and then come back to the waters in which they were planted, but they weren't able to spawn because the rivers and streams just weren't suitable habitat for a number of reasons, including pollution. So they had this non-stop salmon planting program, and Michigan started it, but within a couple of years, other Great Lakes states followed, and pretty soon the Great Lakes were being managed as a recreational fishery. That being said, the federal government did implement a lake trout stocking program because that's the native species. That's the species built to feast on the native fish in the lakes. And so they had like these dual programs, and one was largely federally supported and one was state supported. And the state supported program was much more popular because these were the fish that people wanted to go catch, and it created this industry just out of nowhere, because prior to the lake trout's demise, the only people out on the open waters of the lakes fishing for them were commercial men with nets. Now you have this whole new industry where you needed big boats and big beer
barrels.
Coolers of beer. Yeah. Big gear to go out, go out 30, 40, 50 miles and chase these salmon. And so the more salmon, the more people on the lakes, the more money in fishing licenses, the more gas being bought, the more hotel rooms being filled. So they really basically redlined the Great Lakes. They were putting in more salmon than they could handle, and then came a crash in the 1980s, and they realized that they had to balance the available forage fish, which were primarily alewives, with the predators. So they throttled back on the plantings, and they ended up giving protected status to the alewives. You know, they were once just this nuisance, and then they started banning, like I mentioned earlier, that some commercial guys were going out and harvesting them for a penny or two a pound to be used as cat food or fertilizer, and they stopped that, which is really hard to grasp, because in the 1960s, if somebody would have said we have to protect alewives, you know, heads would have just blown up. People couldn't imagine that there would ever be a time where they wanted alewives. But they built this system that basically worked, but it took a heck of a lot of management. And it lasted for, you know, it peaked in the 1980s, and then it was going strong throughout the 1990s into the early 2000s, and then it blew up, and that may get you to where you want to talk about next time.
But it came
another wave of invasions.
Right.
I'll say that.
But with the salmon, it was just basically they ran out of alefish no matter how much they tried to protect the alefish.
Alewives, yes.
Alewives.
And so the alewives really, you know, so the salmon fishery, first of all, I'll say, it's pretty much gone on Lake Huron. It was never a big fishery on Lake Erie because that's a warmer, shallower lake. It's just different. Erie and Superior are kind of the bookends in the spectrum of the Great Lakes. And while they both have salmon, it's never been that big of an industry. But on Ontario, on Huron, on Michigan, you know, it's big business. And in Lake Ontario, they're all but gone. And the problem was these fish started figuring out how to reproduce. Conditions got better, you know, thanks to the progresses made with the Clean Water Act. The pollution of the tributaries started diminishing, and I think the fish probably started to figure some things out as well. And soon enough, there was some natural reproduction, particularly in the Canadian side of the lakes. But these fish know no borders, so once they spawn, they swim wherever they want. And so the biologists thought they were, you know, maybe by the early 2000s, they thought maybe 20% of the fish in Lake Huron were hatched or were naturally reproduced, and 80% were hatchery raised. Well, when they started doing fin clips to see which ones were coming out of hatcheries and which ones were wild, they realized they had it absolutely backwards. It was 80% natural reproduction. So they were just basically putting in more predators than the lake could handle. At the same time, the alewives were starting to starve. So they're, you know, you got these salmon chasing their tails, and their mouths are going empty because there's just not as much plankton in the lakes, and that's because of this next wave of invasions, which we can talk about in a second. But the result was the collapse of the alewives. Now, it looks like things are headed that direction in Lake Michigan, and conditions are different between the two lakes. Lake Huron is less productive than Lake Michigan because Lake Michigan has a lot of tributaries that carry a lot of nutrients coming off of Wisconsin's farmlands and other states. But still, the salmon fishermen will say last year the fishing was great. The biologists will say, yeah, that's because the fish are starving. Even a rotten fisherman's going to be able to catch a starving fish. So, and that was what the case. That was the case about 10 years ago on Lake Huron. The fishing was great, and then boom, they were gone. And so now we're looking at, is this going to happen on Lake Michigan and on Lake Ontario? And it looks like it is. The alewives are starting to disappear. And it's not just because there's too many salmon in the system. It's because they're not finding enough to eat. And they're not finding enough to eat because a third wave of invaders came after the opening of the Seaway. The lampreys and the alewives arrived before construction of the St. Lawrence Seaway. They came up the earlier shipping channels. Once the Seaway opened, I mentioned earlier, we didn't get the volumes of cargo that we hoped for. In fact, today, on average, fewer than 2 ocean-going ships from overseas make their way into the Seaway system in the Great Lakes every day. And just to give that number some context, that's about the amount of cargo that can be handled by a train, a 100-car train. So we're not getting, you know, loads and loads of cargo. But these boats are carrying, in their ballast tanks, species from ports all over the world. And so these ballast-borne invaders really fundamentally changed the way life works in the Great Lakes, even more than the lamprey alewife infestation, because that was a top of the food chain or food web problem. What the ballast invaders have created is a bottom of the food chain problem. And I'll just real quickly explain what ballast water is.
Yeah, that'd be good, because we're going to run out of time, but I just kind of want to give some plumbing attractions, but we'll talk about next time. So Tell us about ballast water.
Ballast water is used to stabilize big freighters. You know, they're often not filled with cargo, or they're not uniformly loaded with, you know, the same type of cargo. So this creates an imbalance in the boat. And so ballast water is used to balance that imbalance. And it's also used to steady uncargoed ships without cargoes. It's used to help the ships ride lower in the water. They're not meant to bounce around on the open water like a cork. I mean, ballast water is critical to the safe functioning of a boat. It's like just as much as flaps are to a jet, wing flaps. I mean, if you're not properly ballasting, your boat can tip over or it can crack in half, and these things have, in fact, happened. The problem with this weight, it was originally stuff like sand and rocks and then iron, and as the boats got bigger, that became just too inefficient, and they realized water is plenty heavy, and you can pump it on and off a boat really quickly. The problem is, unlike, you know, a rock, this kind of ballast water isn't dead weight. It can be teeming with what I like to say in the book, you know, the most potent pollutant there is, DNA. It can be swarming with species from all around the world, just, you know, itching for a chance to get unloaded in the Great Lakes in exchange for cargo. And as we talked earlier, the lakes are really pretty ecologically naive, or they have been for a long time. So that makes them really vulnerable to these, you know, disruptions. And so since the Seaway opened in 1959, we've had some, I think the running number now is 59 or 60 non-native species introduced by ballast discharges.
Well, next time when we talk, we'll talk about the infamous zebra and guava mussels, which, I mean, the zebra mussels, I think people out here in the Northwest are familiar with, and it's been like a big fear for a number of years now. But what are the other mussels? Begin with a Q.
Guada mussels.
Guada mussels. I actually didn't know about them until I read your book, and they sound like they're even more frightful.
And very problematic.
And I'm currently reading a book right now about the Colorado River system and the problems that they're facing with guava mussels there. So I spent a lot of time there 15 years ago, and it wasn't an issue. So there's what we'll talk about next time is a lot what started in the Great Lakes and how it spread to the rest of the country. And also, I think I'd like to talk more about the pollution that is endemic to the area. And we're going to go out with a song by Randy Newman just to kind of emphasize that problem with the Great Lake area. But that there's been a big move to clean up the Great Lakes. And so another thing to think about for next time is like what the Trump administration's influence on that kind of cleanup effort is going to be, as well as climate change. So that's what we'll talk about next time.
Sounds good.
Okay. So we'll off air, we can discuss when to do this again, but I'm hoping we can talk maybe within about within a month or so.
Okay, yeah, we'll figure something out.
Okay, great. So we've been talking with Dan Egan, who's author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, author William DeBuise will be returning from the Climate March in D.C. to talk about climate change and its particular impact on the North American Southwest. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. And as I mentioned, we're going to go out with Burn On by Randy Newman. Thanks for listening.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's a red on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil bars winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling